Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Film Streams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema on Noon Forum. On today's program, we'll hear a panel discussion which followed a special screening of the 2011 documentary film Hell and Back Again, directed by Danfeng Dennis. This program, presented in collaboration with Metropolitan Community College's Departments of Military and Veteran Support Services and Career Services, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, April 4, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the panelists and do not necessarily represent those of Film Streams, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Hell and Back Again was nominated for an Academy Award this year in the category of Best Full-Length Documentary Film. In 2009, United States Marines launched a major helicopter assault on a Taliban stronghold in southern Afghanistan. Within hours of being dropped deep behind enemy lines, 25-year-old Sergeant Nathan Harris's unit is attacked from all sides. When Sergeant Harris returns home to North Carolina after a life-threatening injury in battle, the film evolves from stunning war reportage to the story of one man's personal apocalypse. With the love and support of his wife, Ashley, Harris struggles to overcome the difficulties of transitioning back to civilian life. The two realities seamlessly intertwine to communicate both the extraordinary drama of war and, for a generation of soldiers, the no less difficult experience of returning home. An unprecedented exploration of the moving image of a film of uncommon intimacy, Hell and Back Again comes full circle as it lays bare the true cost of war. The members of the panel will include Matt Stevens, Student Veterans of America Chapter President, Metropolitan Community College; Paul Greenwell, ADDIE's Program Therapist, Luther and Family Services; and Donna Higgins, OIF-OEF Case Manager, United States Department of Veterans Affairs. The moderator will be Bobby Polk, Metropolitan Community College faculty member. Here now to introduce the program and the panel is Todd Simon.
This event is part of the FilmStream's Community Development Program, which allows us to collaborate throughout the year with nonprofits and community groups on films and discussions that relate to their missions and important work. Tonight, we're honored to partner with Metro Community College's Military and Veteran Support Services and Career Service Departments. In just a moment, Bobby and Ayana from Metro will say a few words and make a special presentation. So please welcome Bobby and Ayana.
I'm Bobby Loud. I'm the director of the Military and Veteran Support Services at Metropolitan Community College. And our department is specifically focused on easing the transition of veterans and service members as they return to our community. For this event, we also partner with Career Services, and I'll let Ayana introduce herself.
Good evening. My name is Ayana Boykins. I work as the coordinator of Career Services at Metropolitan Community College. And we feel so fortunate and grateful to Film Streams for partnering with us or allowing us to work with you to present this wonderful film. It was just Oscar nominated, just came out just this past year, and we're really addressing incredibly important issues tonight, and I'm happy that Film Streams really allowed this opportunity to come about.
Thank you. Ayana and I, when we began to actually plan this particular portion of the event, we wanted to make sure that we took this optimal time to acknowledge two individuals that have not only one served as a veteran and the other individual has made such a tremendous impact in the performing arts community here in the metropolitan area. I thought it fitting for this occasion. And at this particular time, I will have Ayana to present the first honoree for tonight.
I have the esteemed honor to introduce our first veteran service honoree, Dr. Mary J. Goodwin Klinkscale's story is one of development, advancement, and progress. Her passion for fulfilling the need for better is what motivated her throughout her life to seek ways of improvement. Beginning in the heart of Arkansas as a young child, As a young child, she was exposed to the adverse conditions of the extreme South, witnessing firsthand the experience of brutal labor and circumstances that would mold and inspire her to unearth her God-given talents. Dr. C has worked with individuals locally and nationally to produce and direct many notable performances. And I might add that she's planned, directed, and produced over 300 performances. Amazing. Two in particular were in honor of legendary Tuskegee Airmen, both in Omaha and Milwaukee, as a prelude to their receiving Congressional Medal of Honor awards in Washington, D.C. in 2007. Dr. C and her staff continue to meet with individuals and organizations working on collaborations as a result of the Growing and Building Together Academy of the Arts. And they'll be partnering with Nathan Hale Junior High for its 2012 summer program by offering visual arts classes to students. Dr. C has received numerous awards and has an educational doctorate in administration, organization, and organization from the International Apostolic University of Grace and Truth in Columbus, Ohio, and is a licensed cosmetologist and also a salon owner of the Grand Barber and Beauty Salon in Bellevue, Nebraska. Like the Tuskegee Airmen, Dr. C continues to soar as a pioneer, promoting the arts to improve the lives of others in community and especially for youth and future generations. If you'll come down to receive your award, Dr. Mary J. Goodwin Klinkscale.
Dr. C, on behalf of the Office of Military and Veteran Support Services and myself, we would like to present you with this Veteran Support Service Award for the outstanding things that you have done in support of those who have served our country. Thank you, Dr. C. We appreciate you. And the last honoree that we have prior to going into our program is a person that I personally appreciate so very much. And when we thought about a veteran, I couldn't think of anyone who would be more deserving than this award than Dr. Bishop Nelson George Turner. Bishop Turner has pastored Greater Bethel Temple Church for the past 40 years. He is the presiding bishop of the Apostolic Pentecostal Churches Incorporated. Dr. Turner is a true example of leadership and commitment to excellence in all that he has done. His commitment to serving others has earned him the title of trustworthy, activist, visionary, and mentor. He has been recognized within our community as a man of principle and that of courage. Bishop Turner is a veteran of the Korean War, in which he served on the USS General J.C. Breckinridge. While traveling to Japan, his leadership and his skills were recognized by his commander, in which he became responsible for the supervision of 12 other airmen. Dr. Turner himself found himself in the middle of battle while serving in Uzbekistan, Korea. As a member of the Security Forces Unit, his time was spent in the front lines, was very tense, and he was bunkered down in foxholes while bombs dropped around him. After serving over a year in Korea, Bishop Turner arrived back in Berkeley, California, to find his country still divided along racial lines with no welcoming parties or parades. He is still here with us tonight. Please help us in saluting Bishop Dr. Nelson George Turner for his bravery, his dedication, and his commitment to our country and also to our community. Let's welcome Dr. Bishop Nelson George Turner. Dr. Bishop Nelson George Turner, on behalf of Metropolitan Community College and the Office of Military and Veteran Support Services, we would like to thank you for your sacrifice, your bravery, your dedication, and your loyalty to this country and to the city of Omaha. Thank you so much, Bishop. Thank you so much. We will be having a panel which will be moderated by none other than Colonel Bobby Polk. For our two honorees, Bishop Nelson George Turner and Dr. Mary J. Klingscale, thank you so much for your participation on this evening.
Okay, my name is Bobby Polk. I'm going to be the moderator for this, for the panel. So if anybody has any questions or comments they would like to make, feel free.
I was wondering if you could talk about the post-traumatic stress that you saw the Marine exhibiting during the movie, and maybe relate it to some of what you see here.
Absolutely. First off, I am Paul Greenwell. I'm with Lutheran Family Services at East Program, and our program is honored to be able to serve a veteran-specific population along with their families and loved ones. Do we want to go and introduce ourselves real quick?
Yeah.
And then we'll take the question.
Okay. Good evening. I'm Donna Higgins. I am a case manager at the VA in Omaha. I work directly just with Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom. I just work with combat vets. I also have a son who's active duty Army. He's done two tours. He's also a Purple Heart recipient, so I know what it feels like to have somebody injured in theater. And my husband just retired after 25 years of active duty Army. He was an Apache pilot, and he's done three tours also in combat. So I take that experience and kind of bring it to the VA, not as a veteran, but as someone that's been experienced some of the things that we saw in the movie that the wife saw.
My name is Bobby Polk. I'm the criminal justice program director at Metro. I guess I'd want to say that I've spent 30 years in the military. Day I graduated from college, I was commissioned a second lieutenant in the Marine Corps. Spent 3 years in the Marine Corps. After I got off active duty, I spent 2 years in the Nebraska National Guard and then 25 years in the Army Reserve. Retired as a colonel, MP. And that's my background.
I'm Matt Stevens, OIF veteran. I've spent 7 years in the Army National Guard. Spent about 8 months in Iraq. That's about my story.
So the question was about specific possible symptoms that we may have seen in the movie and then how we may have seen those. The most prevalent symptom is simply the exposure to an event where there could be a perceived or real threat to one's life, and clearly through the movie you see that on multiple occasions, many occasions throughout the movie. Another one that really jumps out, and probably everybody noticed that, was his attachment to those pistols, and just how common it is for our folks who come back who have a lot of those experiences just to have that as kind of a security blanket for them. So what that really would suggest is that is kind of a way for him to cope with anxiety, a way for him to feel safer in his environment. So that hyperarousal and that anxiety that's common for PTSD is something we saw there. Another one of those things that we often see is those interpersonal relationships. So there's a lot of conflict, a lot of anger. That is also something we saw. The movie would suggest, and I want to be a little cautious, it would suggest that he has these reoccurring images or visions or kind of a re-experiencing of some of those events, and that is also a very common symptom of folks who come back with post-traumatic stress.
Questions?
Hi, I work with people who have had brain injuries and trauma. I can't think of any who were service-related or combat-related. But what I was amazed at in the movie was the ability of this young man to communicate. So often, particularly men who may not be that communicative in the first place, and then they've been injured, I think have a really tough time communicating what they're feeling, what they're experiencing, and that just, you know, exacerbates the situation. So I was curious if you had, if you thought the same thing as me, that this person was unusually able to communicate what he was going through.
Okay. I think that's very true. It takes a lot to get them to seek help. That's why the VA works with Eddie's as much as we do. We don't care where you get help, but just please do that. They often will just want to talk to their buddies, their Army buddies that they share that, you know, camaraderie with. They've lost their community when they come back. They feel like nobody else understands them. So get them to talk about anything, to talk about their feelings. So I did feel like he did talk a lot. I'm not sure if that was because the movie was on him, because we don't often see that often. So, and traumatic brain injury, as you know, is the signature. So we have, but a lot of the symptoms of traumatic brain injury, the TBI and PTSD, are often similar. The irritability, the anger, the rage, they get agitated very easily. So those two things are very common. They didn't talk about a TBI with him, but I wonder how much he experienced.
I'm also curious about the possible relationship of Sergeant Harris to the film crew and some of the folks who were actually in theater with him, if possibly some of that shared experience was kind of a nice avenue for him to actually have those discussions and be a little bit more open.
My question was related to the fact that you said it's actually good to get them to talk about their experiences, because I guess my thought was, out of respect for veterans, to not ask them about certain things because it could be disturbing to them. So I guess my question is how can we, as someone who's not maybe had that experience, be supportive of veterans? And other than being grateful for what they've done, are you suggesting that we should ask them about those things? I don't know.
Well, I would say no. Okay. I think you just have to listen to them. And give them the space and the time that they need, and just kind of respect them. Some of them like to talk about it, and some of them don't, but it has to be their choice. For most of them, they just went a year without any choices. They were taught every day to get up, to do a mission, to keep themselves alive, to keep their buddies alive, and they just stuffed all of that. And when they come back, that's pretty much what they're still doing. They know how to go through the day and not think and not feel and just do what they're supposed to be doing. So just let them, give them their time and space. I don't know.
Absolutely. The other part, and I was talking to some of my folks earlier today, was his wife, of just watching her experience. And sometimes as a spouse, of how do you get somebody to get help? And sometimes all you can really do is, A, take care of yourself, and as folks in the community who care about our military, one of those things we can do is simply be available for those people to help them take care of themselves, be an ear for them. But then, like Donna was saying, you know, in time, if it's their choice and as they decide to be more open, of being an available ear for these folks.
I'd like to add, not to go into too much detail and stuff, I remember when my mom, I was about ready to confront her about what happened. Something you'd like to remember is when someone's ready to talk, that's their time to talk. My mom, you know, she tried to interject her opinion when I didn't need it, when I didn't want it. Actually, I should say, not necessarily not when I needed it, because I did need it, but not when I wanted it. She tried telling me what I needed to do, and that was to go to the VA, which was very much true. I did need to go to the VA. The problem was is I had a drinking problem, and you know, that had come up and stuff. and it wasn't the time that I needed her to tell me it's time to go to the VA. I just needed her to listen and listen to what I had to say and let me get everything off my chest that I needed to. So I would suggest you just need to have that relationship, and you need to allow them to come forth when they're ready to come forth, and not dictate what needs to happen. Allow them to dictate what needs to happen on their own time.
You know, this is a different war. I deployed for Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and when I got home, you know, it was 2 or 3 months before I thought I was back to normal. But these guys, you know, this is the longest war that we have been involved in. 2004, 2005, I deployed Fort Riley, Kansas, and my job was to mobilize units and then see units when they came home. And a lot of the guys were just totally different. And so I think you kind of have to take it individually. And when they're ready to talk, when they're ready to tell you about something, then let them talk. Otherwise, you know, just let them talk on their own time. I think that's the key.
There were certainly a lot of scenes in the movie which were poignant, but one which resonated with me was when Sergeant Harris was going through his bag of drugs, medication, and, you know, in the United States, it's certainly a billion-dollar industry, and we can talk as a society about society's reliance on medication. But with some of those drugs, for instance, OxyContin, I know that's very addictive, and I'm thinking in some ways, I'm wondering just how the solution can be also part of the problem too. So I'm just wondering if you can talk about reliance on medication when soldiers return.
There you go. I'll talk on what the VA is doing. You're absolutely right. They're like Matt. A lot of people will come home. They're not going to get help, so they start drinking. That's how they deal with their feelings, their thoughts. It helps them get to sleep at night. It helps them not feel those emotions. So the last thing we want to do is give them all kinds of pain medication. But the flip side of that is they are in a lot of pain and they're really suffering. We've offered a lot of different alternatives now where we actually have hypnosis at the VA. We have a yoga classes, which is pretty amazing that we have these big, bulky Marines with tattoos all over them, and they're doing yoga. But they like it, and it's working. So we're really reaching out for whatever evidence base is out there that's going to help with people with PTSD, and they're responding to it. I mean, they're open to. There's a certain amount of that you are in pain. I think they responded to this in the film that you are, they're going to live with some pain for the rest of their lives, and they're young. So it's, but yeah, there's all kinds of alternatives, and they're really working hard that we don't make them dependent the rest of their lives on those, and we continue to work with them.
The VA does an awesome job of not giving, at least me, I can only speak from my experience, but they do an awesome job of not giving me meds that are going to be addictive. There's something in my file that already pops up that says, I don't know what it says, but basically it's do not give this person addictive meds because, you know, I have back problems, I have neck problems, and, you know, I, through my efforts and stuff, to remind the doctor, oh yeah, by the way, I can't have this because I have an addictive personality and I can't take these because I've had substance abuse problems. You know, they're already like, I know, it's okay, we got you covered and everything. And they already give me medicine that, you know, isn't narcotic, because I had those problems. I've come into the VA, you know, with stuff in my system and everything. So they're fully aware. So they do an excellent job of making sure that I don't relapse and I'm not given drugs that are going to hinder my recovery.
Two things. One's a comment. Recently, in fact, last month, I spoke with a leading physician at Walter Reed about traumatic brain injury, and I asked him a question about the correlation between traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress disorder, question being, could you even not have post-traumatic stress disorder from his experience? And he said, probably not, although he hasn't been involved in every diagnosis. Okay, so that was just a piece of information I thought might be useful. It's a high-level piece of knowledge. But I have a question about the film in terms of veterans who may have seen it. Maybe you have data, maybe you don't. But is the film therapeutic or not? Is it something that should be seen or not by veterans who have been diagnosed with PTSD?
I'd say no. I saw the trailer, and I couldn't watch the film. I showed up at 8:30 to do the panel, but I can't. And that's just me personally. It was just difficult to see the same stuff that I went through. I know in the trailer it showed him with a pistol and putting it to his head. That's the same stuff that I did. That's the same stuff that I went through overseas. So it might be therapeutic for some people, but for me it wasn't. And I'm sure there's a couple other people that would find no, that it's too difficult. But there's some people that can. I mean, I think it's a hit or miss.
There's some level of exposure within treatment protocols that is helpful, but that is done in a very controlled environment. And as a clinician, that's only something I go toward after I really know somebody and know what their skills are in terms of being able to handle some of that exposure. Some of that will just be imaginal exposure, just even like thinking through an incident. If you get to a point where you can do some of that, then exposure to a movie, especially movies where it's much more real than the Hollywood versions of what we've come to be familiar with. So it's a potential thing, but definitely something you want to do, in my opinion, in a controlled environment.
Retired Army Sergeant, getting diagnosed with PTSD not otherwise specified. Still, doctor hasn't been able to explain exactly what the difference is to me, but my understanding was always PTSD was PTSD. So, of course, I know it's an issue of dealing with money, dealing with those that have a greater need than others may have, and so therefore they have the different specifications for it. But to answer the gentleman's question, it takes time. You know, when I was in the Gulf War, just this year I was finally able to actually tell my daughter, my own daughter, that I was diagnosed with PTSD. So sitting here now, you know, being able to actually watch this, don't know what might happen tonight when I go to bed, but it takes time. It takes healing. As you know, doctors, they do the sewing up and the stitching up and try to heal the body, but there's only one that can heal the mind, and that's God.
Yes, I would just like to comment on this. I'm a non-vet, and I'm a traumatic brain injury also. I have a problem with PTSD. Yes, I have been treated approximately since 75. I hid out for 10 years. And, I know what the story's about. I slept with a revolver under my mattress for 13 years until my wife found it, and she freaked out. And it's a problem when you go through so many situations like this of losing good friends and close associates. And the one point I would make is if you're going to present a program to this, make sure you know the individuals, you've dealt with them for a period of time before you throw them into a situation like this, because it even bothers me tonight. I cannot get the smell of burnt flesh out of my system. And it's one of those things, I thank God. My pastor's sitting here. He has run my life for the last 20 years, and I thank God for him because I'm able to go home at night. I know I have somebody looking out for me, and if I need to call him, I can call him 24 hours a day. And he is always in my corner. And that's something that I can't tell the rest of the world that they need to do, but I can sure give them a strong recommendation for it because it's put a strong backbone in my system of belief and in my comprehension of what's going on.
The battle buddy system, so prevalent within the military, when you leave service, that's kind of a bond and a relationship that you frequently lose. So when we start talking about what we as community members can do, it's simply that of maybe stepping out to some degree and taking the place of a battle buddy.
This is my second time watching the documentary, and it just it's gut wrenching to watch. As just a civilian, I just once again want to reiterate how much I appreciate FilmStreams being able to present this information to the Omaha community. How many service members are we seeing coming into the At-Ease program and also Veterans Administration?
At-Ease is right about 3 years old, and we've surpassed over 200 individuals coming through the program, and it equates to something over 2,000 hours of services, and that doesn't include peer supporter group services that aren't necessarily logged. So I think as we look at numbers and we look at the need for services, the VA and programs like At-Ease and really anybody else who's willing to take a step out and serve these folks, it's just going to be all the more important.
And I don't know the exact numbers that are enrolled in our PTSD. I know in the OEF-OEF program, we've enrolled about 6,000 veterans over since both wars began. And my job is to link them up with services so they can go out into the community. We enroll them with our mental health. We also have the vet center. So they're all... And we have what we call CBOX, community-based outreach centers, like in North Fork and North Platte. So we also fee out sometimes. So because that's the thing about Nebraska, when you look in the movie, you see the community that they had and the support that they had from each other. And then you go back to rural Nebraska somewhere where there's people that don't even know there's a war going on. And that's pretty tough to take. So I don't know our exact numbers, but we surely, we're at 6,000 soldiers that we've enrolled back in since they've been back.
I was just curious if you could talk a little bit about EMDR therapy. I've heard that that's being used quite a bit now for the PTSD sufferers, and I'm just curious what your experiences with that have been.
EMDR stands for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. The theory behind it being is that during a traumatic experience, the brain processes that occur kind of lock in that experience, not just with the visuals, but also sights, sounds, smells. We heard earlier that even just kind of getting some of those sensory things out of the way are difficult. So the aim of EMDR is to be able to reprocess these past experiences, these traumas, but doing that with a kind of a foot in the present where you can reprocess it from more of a present perspective. So using new knowledge, new perspective, information you've learned about PTSD, about your trauma, because in reality, these experiences are locked in the brain in a very specific way. And so when we're triggered it could be a knock on the door. It could be just somebody yelling from the back of the building or something. But EMDR just aims to reprocess those things from a more present perspective.
I'd just like to sort of play devil's advocate a little bit. I work for the VA also, and I work with PTSD and some traumatic brain injury and military sexual trauma. And I've worked with trauma for about 10 years. One of the things that it's really important to do is to not equate veteran with PTSD or combat veteran with PTSD, because we know that about a third of the people who are subjected to an overwhelming, horrifying, terrifying experience that would be a cause of PTSD, only about a third of them actually do go on to develop chronic PTSD. About two-thirds of them get better on their own. And it's not to say that they don't have unpleasant memories and unpleasant experiences, but the disease state of post-traumatic stress disorder, which involves a combination of that hyper-anxiety and getting the re-intrusive experiences and emotional numbing and avoidance, the syndrome actually develops in about a third of the people. And if you think about what the U.S. went through in the months after 9/11, where, you know, people were in shell shock for a few days and then hyper-vigilant for weeks, but really by Christmas, most people were not traumatized anymore. And that's the natural course of how the human being deals with a traumatic experience. We don't know what it is that makes the third who don't get over it not get over it. But I just want everybody to be aware that so many of our vets are really afraid that if you hear the word veteran, you're going to think they have PTSD, and you're going to think they've got a handgun in the glove box, and you're going to think that they're about to go off. So maybe you can talk a little bit about your own experiences about the range of the reactions people have developed.
The range would be exactly what you just said. Folks who would qualify for a diagnosis of PTSD, but still are fully functioning, hold full-time jobs, are great parents, are engaged with their children, all the way to the other end of the spectrum, where folks are isolated in their homes for weeks, months, or even a year at a time, simply because they don't feel safe. There was an interesting article online earlier today about folks who are interviewing veterans who want to hire veterans, but they start asking interview questions about your experience just to kind of piece out if there is some issue that they need to worry about as an employer. Even beyond that, with our National Guard troops coming back trying to get employment, a lot of folks are kind of concerned about hiring veterans because they might not be there next week. They might be put on orders, and you have to legally hold that job for them now. It's real. As a community, we really need to decide how much we're going to support our veterans in what ways, very real ways, in terms of, are you willing to hire a veteran? Are you willing to go to the veteran-specific job fairs and really put yourself out there? So, like I said, the majority of these folks come back, and they're just fine. They even grow from their experience, and they're better for it.
I was wondering about the war video game. Is that a common thing? Is it like a coping mechanism when veterans can no longer be doing what they're doing? And is that a good thing or a bad thing? Because I found it scary.
I will comment on that. When my husband first went to war, the war had just broke out. And he wasn't there 2 or 3 months when I got a visa bill that we had bought an Xbox. And we bought 2 Xboxes and a television. And I'm like, what? I thought there was a war going on. I watched CNN. That's what I saw. And that's what they would do. He's an Apache pilot, so he did his missions at night. And during the day, they lived in tents, but they had TVs, Xboxes, and they played Halo against each other. And for me, as a social worker, that was about as inappropriate as you could get. But that's how they survived. They played that game. They were extremely competitive. He was an officer. I didn't think he should be shooting at his enlisted soldiers. But that's how they developed those. They maintained that, was to be able. And he came home. Both my son and husband came home and played Halo until I just said, I can't have this in my house anymore. It's very, very disturbing. But you might be able to talk about it, Matt. But that's what went on in my home.
I don't really have a whole lot of experience with war games. With the recent stuff that's come out, I didn't play it because I was more afraid of what feelings would come up than anything. So I just avoided it. Avoiding is my biggest technique. If any of you guys were to meet me, avoiding is huge for me. I love to avoid stuff. If anything makes me feel uncomfortable, I avoid it. And so video games and stuff that I thought might trigger something, I just avoided it. But again, I can't speak for everybody else. I know there's a lot of guys that love to play those video games and stuff and love to do all that stuff and just love it. But like I said, if there's anything that I can avoid that makes me feel uncomfortable, I avoid it.
Along with the avoidance, I think something you can consider is these folks returning from combat operations are used to being at such an intense level all the time. They talk about a combat cycle, but once you deploy, you really don't come down off of that until you come home. So you're in this constant state of being at an intensity level of 10 anyway. So when you come home, one of the things that we will see is folks simply engaging in activities that do kind of get that blood going again, of trying to get that same level of intensity back. It is a great avoider. It's hard to have a conversation with me while I'm playing my video games, so it could be seen a number of different ways.
When I was watching, the gentleman shown in the film, his identity is so tied up in being in theater and being a grunt and all those things. It's almost a grieving process, it seems to me, that he's going to have to redefine his purpose. And I guess for those of you that work or have experienced it yourselves, how do you work through that process of re-identifying?
I haven't yet. It's still a struggle. I can't be in the Army. I'm going through a med board, which is basically just a medical board is to tell me that basically I'm not fit to be in the military anymore. And that was my choosing. They didn't straight out say, you can't be in the military anymore. I told them I couldn't. I haven't dealt with it. I haven't coped with it. It's still a struggle every day. I want to be in the military. I used to enjoy the military. I used to love the military, and I can't do it anymore. And it's hard for me. And I don't know how to cope with it. I just try to.
I wish there were an easy answer to that. There's not. And I think this is another one of those places where as a community, friends and family can step in and start brainstorming ways. How can they still be engaged with something that's so important to them, that's such a passion for them? In cases where they're not able to, what are the new avenues for you to pursue? What are the other passions? What else is in your life that's important? And you're right, it is a grieving process. There's no better way of putting it than that.
And that when they do get injured like he did, that's one of the things that we really struggle with, is they didn't get closure. They just got taken out of the theater. And then there's a lot of guilt that they didn't stay there, they didn't continue to fight. So those are all the different aspects that go along with not only are they physically injured, They didn't get that closure. They didn't get to say goodbye. I remember working with a Marine. I think they're the toughest that I work with, who I'd worked with for about a year and had made very little progress, was just stuck. And that's what it took. We have Wounded Warrior, Marine Wounded Warrior, and I got them together as a group. And he was able to say when we weren't fighting, one of the other Marines told him, when we were fighting and we didn't know what the hell we were fighting for, it was for you. You took the bullet for us and we were fighting for you. So sometimes it takes each other if they didn't get that closure and they didn't get to, but it's kind of a grieving process. And, you know, I've had a lot of them say to me, the proudest moment in my life and was when I saw myself in my uniform or when I stood up and gave my oath. And then it gets ripped away from them and they don't have choices about it. So there's so much that have happened to them that they didn't have choices. And that's why we as a community just have to allow them to take it one step at a time and let them get their choices now.
I'll take that one step further. It's something that the VA's doing, that At Ease is doing, that Metro is doing, Metropolitan Community College is doing, is putting groups together where these folks can come together, where soldiers, airmen, Marines, sailors can all come together and be in an environment with other folks who've been there and done that, trying to restore some of that camaraderie that's such a part of the military. As a clinician, I've seen the difference between folks who simply come and see me on a weekly basis versus those who come and see me but also participate in some type of activity with military peers. Their progress is significantly different in my experience. So the ability to connect and stay connected with others, other veterans, active duty personnel, in some ways having that connection.
That's going to be one of the things I think as time goes on we really won't know. National Guard and Reserves, when they come home, they demobilize, take a vacation, and then they go right back to their civilian job. Where the Marines, active duty, they go right back in the sense of having that group of guys that they've been with all the time. And so I think as time goes on, we're going to have to look at that in the sense of National Guard and Reserve, because, again, you're working your civilian job, you get called up, you mobilize, demobilize, take vacation, and go back to work. Going to have an impact.
I hope that groups like American Legion and VFW stay around for a long time. They've been, for years, have been a great avenue for just that, for being able to stay connected with other peers.
Well, thank you to all of the panelists tonight, and thank you to Metropolitan Community College for collaborating with FilmStreams and bringing this event, and thank you all for being here tonight.
Thank you.
We've heard a panel discussion which followed a screening of the 2011 documentary film Hell and Back Again, directed by Danfeng Dennis. The event took place at FilmStreams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema. This program, presented in collaboration with Metropolitan Community College's Departments of Military and Veteran Support Services and Career Services, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, April 4th, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The members of the panel have included Matt Stevens, Student Veterans of America Chapter President, Metropolitan Community College, Paul Greenwell, At Ease Program Therapist, Lutheran Family Services, and Donna Higgins, OIF, OEF Case Manager, United States Department of Veterans Affairs. The moderator was Bobby Polk, Metropolitan Community College faculty member. Special thanks to Rachel Jacobson, Casey Logan, Hallie Sharkey, and Jim Foyt of FilmStreams for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening. To conclude today's program, in anticipation of Independence Day on Wednesday, we'll present a special reading of the Declaration of Independence. It will be read by several actors, including Mel Gibson, Michael Douglas, Kathy Bates, Kevin Spacey, Whoopi Goldberg, Edward Norton, Renee Zellweger, Ming Na, Winona Ryder, Benicio del Toro, and Graham Greene. At this time in our nation's history, it is especially important for us to hear and remember the words of Thomas Jefferson, written 236 years ago, and to think how important they still are to our daily lives.
When, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them.
A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government.
Laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness.
Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes.
And accordingly, all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed.
But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security.
Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government.
The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states.
To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world.
He has refused his assent to laws the most wholesome and necessary for the public good.
He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance unless suspended in their operation till his assent should be obtained. And when so suspended, he has utterly neglected to attend to them.
He has refused to pass other laws for the accommodation of large districts of people unless those people would relinquish the right of representation in the legislature, a right inestimable to them and formidable only to tyrants.
He has called together legislative bodies at places unusual, uncomfortable, and distant from the depository of their public records for the sole purpose of fatiguing them into compliance with his measures.
He has dissolved representative houses repeatedly for opposing with manly firmness his invasions on the rights of the people.
He has refused for a long time after such dissolutions to cause others to be elected, whereby the legislative powers, incapable of annihilation, have returned to the people at large for their exercise, the state remaining in the meantime exposed to all the dangers of invasion from without and convulsions within.
He has endeavored to prevent the population of these states, for that purpose obstructing the laws for naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migrations hither, and raising the conditions of new appropriations of lands.
He has obstructed the administration of justice by refusing his assent to laws for establishing judiciary powers.
He has made judges dependent on his will alone for the tenure of their offices and the amount and payment of their salaries.
He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance.
He has kept among us in times of peace standing armies without the consent of our legislatures.
He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power.
He has combined with others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and unacknowledged by our laws, giving his assent to their acts of pretended legislation.
For quartering large bodies of armed troops among us.
For protecting them by a mock trial from punishment for any murders which they should commit on the inhabitants of these states.
For cutting off our trade with all parts of the world. For imposing taxes on us without our consent.
For depriving us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury. For transporting us beyond seas to be tried for pretended offenses.
For abolishing the free system of English laws in a neighboring province, establishing therein an arbitrary government, and enlarging its boundaries so as to render it at once an example and fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule into these colonies.
For taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, and altering fundamentally the forms of our governments.
For suspending our own legislatures and declaring themselves invested with power to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever.
He has abdicated government here by declaring us out of his protection and waging war against us.
He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people.
He is, at this time, transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny, already begun with circumstances of cruelty and perfidy, scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous ages, and totally unworthy of the head of a civilized nation.
He has constrained our fellow citizens taken captive on the high seas to bear arms against their country, to become the executioners of their friends and brethren, or to fall themselves by their hands.
He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions.
In every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury. A prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people.
Nor have we been wanting in attentions to our British brethren. We have warned them from time to time of attempts by their legislature to extend an unwarrantable jurisdiction over us.
We have reminded them of the circumstances of our immigration and settlement here.
We have appealed to their native justice and magnanimity.
And we have conjured them by the ties of our common kindred to disavow these usurpations which would inevitably interrupt our connections and correspondence. They, too, have been deaf to the voice of justice and of consanguinity. We must, therefore, acquiesce in the necessity which denounces our separation and hold them, as we hold the rest of mankind, enemies in war, in peace, friends.
We, therefore, the representatives of the United States of America, in General Congress assembled,
appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do, in the name and by authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare
that these United Colonies are, and of right, ought to be free and independent states.
That they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown.
And that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved.
And that as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce.
And to do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do.
And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence,
we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor.